This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Waiting for tear gas, white globe to black. The working idea was to move with the flow of protest from dawn to 3 a.m. if need be, taking in the lulls, the waiting, and the margins of events. The rule of thumb for this sort of anti-photojournalism: no flash, no telephoto or zoom lens, no gas mask, no autofocus, no press pass, and no pressure to grab at all costs the one defining image of dramatic violence. Later, working at the light table and reading the increasingly stereotypical descriptions of the new face of protest, I realized all the more that a simple descriptive physiognomy was warranted. The alliance on the streets was indeed stranger, more varied and inspired than could be conveyed by cute alliterative play with teamsters and turtles. Describe the attitudes of people waiting, unarmed, sometimes deliberately naked in the winter chill for the gas and the rubber bullets and the concussion grenades. There were moments of civic solemnity, of urban anxiety, and of carnival. Again, something very simple is missed by descriptions of this as a movement founded in cyberspace. The human body asserts itself in the city streets against the abstraction of global capital. There was a strong feminist dimension to this testimony, and there was also a dimension grounded in the experience of work. It was the men and women who work on the docks, after all, who shut down the flow of metal boxes from Asia, relying on individual knowledge that there is always another body on the other side of the sea doing the same work, that all this global trade is more than a matter of a mouse click. One fleeting hallucination could not be photographed. As the blast of stun grenades reverberated amidst the downtown skyscrapers, someone with a boombox thoughtfully provided a musical accompaniment, Jimi Hendrix's mock hysterical rendition of the American national anthem. At that moment, Hendrix returned to the streets of Seattle, slyly caricaturing the pumped-up sovereignty of the world's only superpower. So the text, I actually wrote the text in Rotterdam in September of 2000 for a book that was being published by Verso, the British, which was the main text in the book were written by Alexander Coburn and Jeffrey St. Clair, who run a website called Counterpunch, which you may know, some of you may know. I think Cheryl Conkleton may be here tonight, and the opportunity to do this work came from Cheryl because she had invited me to show my big project Fish Story at the Henry Art Gallery in Seattle. And as a follow-up to that, that occurred in the early winter of 1999, and in February, I think the opening was. And then there were a whole series of forums organized about working class responses to globalization, most of which were contributing to the beginning of the movement to resist the World Trade Organization event meeting that occurred in November of that year. And I was going up frequently from Los Angeles, where I lived, to Seattle, and then it occurred to me that Cheryl, at that point, was a curator at the Henry Art Gallery, and they wanted me to they hoped I could do some new projects, so I proposed doing two things. One was to go swimming in front of Bill Gates' house, and I made a little triptych, and I wrote a letter to Gates asking him why he bought this Winslow Homer painting of cod fishermen lost on the Grand Banks. And then I said I wanted to come up and take part in the protests against the World Trade Organization. So it's out of that this simple slide piece, Waiting for Tear Gas, occurred.
Yeah. I think for me it was so overwhelming because the Iraq War had started and I had been to so many demonstrations. But now, of course, the work is so resonant in terms of the Occupy movement. And I imagine it will just move through history, forming alliances with further protests. Shall we look at it?
Yeah. I'm just bringing it up here.
So Alan has done many works using the slideshow as a medium, and we can maybe talk about that after this piece is shown.
I'll go through it fairly quickly. I usually try to work with about a 10 to 15 second interval with slides, and I don't use fancy fades or anything that simulates cinematic cutting, so you're very aware that you're seeing a sequence of individual images with a black time in between. So actually in a PowerPoint, or you know, it goes a little more cinematically because there's a kind of cut that occurs. Oh, there's the text, okay. So the piece is bracketed with a white globe at the front, and you'll see at the end the black globe. I can say a little bit. I mean, it's not normally a piece that requires any narration, but I can tell you a few things just intermittently. These were kids from a special high school for gay and lesbian students to sort of protect them from, you know, trouble with bigoted straight kids, and they had dressed up as devils and were out probably earlier than anyone. You know, they were protesting before there was a protest. And they were among the more inventive people on the streets. One choice I had to make on the day that the protest began in earnest was whether to go with the direct action group at 6 in the morning or go to a labor rally in the big stadium in central Seattle. And I decided to go with the labor rally because I actually thought that was going to be the largest group of people and the most varied, and I was convinced that the character of this thing was largely an expression of working class well-founded working class anxieties about the future, you know, and of course that intuition ran counter to the way the media was already predisposed to cover this, which was as a kind of guilty idle response by the children of the rich. So there were large groups of farm workers from eastern Washington State who work in the apple orchards and such. You can see people yawning from the long bus ride in from eastern Washington. And as the march began, Jeffrey St. Clair gives a very good account of this in his text in the book. The march split between most of the unions, which turned away from a direct confrontation with the site of the plenary session of the World Trade Organization meeting, and the more militant unions, which joined with the direct action groups to actually go to the Paramount Theater and block the meeting. So, and those two unions were the West Coast Longshore Union, ILWU, and some local Teamsters locals in Seattle, in the Seattle area, which tended to be rather left-wing, kind of dissident Teamsters. So I stayed with ILWU people because I knew a lot of them, and there were a whole group from L.A., for example, from Los Angeles who'd come up. This group here is from Los Angeles. Oddly enough, President Clinton appeared and went to visit the port, so the head of the Seattle local had to go from the protest to sort of give Clinton a tour of the container terminals. And of course, the day before, the port had actually been shut down as a job action against the WTO. There were a group of radical lesbians who decided to make the matter of bovine growth hormones their main issue, so they paraded topless with labels saying no BGH taped to their breasts. No, this is someone else. Yeah, this is a woman from Seattle, and every so often she reminds me I need to send her a picture, and I have to do it. Maybe someone can I'll find her email and someone can photograph this picture on the screen and tell her she's a star in Philadelphia for a few seconds. Yeah, I'm behind. She wants to show her grandkids this picture. She tracked me down. People track me down and ask for photos of this. So everybody's waiting because they know now that the police are using gas. It was a good business climate for surplus stores. And one thing I did is once night fell, I would change the film depending on sort of act. I would go from tungsten balanced film to daylight balanced film to sort of think of a structuring difference in color. If you want to have a photogenic protest, you want to... rainy Christmas time Seattle isn't bad because you get this incredible reflection and the extra lights of Christmas. But nowadays with digital cameras and automatic white balancing, you don't have the opportunity to let your color go off unless you go into the menu and set it off, set it a different way. So there's a kind of yellow segment where things kind of begin to wind up. People start getting hurt. It's sort of hard on the police. You know, they wear these outfits that are... It's like being dressed up as a crow in front of a taco stand in Los Angeles for hours. And, of course, the police are paid much better, but it doesn't help their temper. You know, and I'll say a little bit more about that later. I feel like these all look very familiar now because you've seen the latest reiteration, but the whole point of making the slide piece became, especially after the events of September 11th and the suppression of the protests in Genoa, where it was clear that internationally the police had arrived at a new set of strategies for provocation and encirclement of protesters, that just the circulation of the slideshow was part of keeping the memory of this moment of eruption and dissent alive, you know, over the long night, you might say, of the war on terror. So It's good in a way that now all this has returned. You know, I don't mean the repression, but the spirit of dissent. Oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong way. So you're effectively blind. I mean, it's interesting to try to photograph when you can't see, and especially at night when I'm focusing, you know, wide open, which is a very shallow depth of field, but trying to do that through tears, you know. Oh, sorry. And basically, the one central hotel, I'm forgetting the name now, is it Sheraton or... Where Clinton was staying was kind of heavily fortified. There were buses parked around it. But the protesters pretty much had taken over the streets. So there was no, you know, you had all these Secret Service guys and FBI and such inside sort of freaking out. And it was a kind of party on the street, Seattle style. Looking at it now, you realize how far in advance Seattle fashions are. They set the mode for the colder climes. Japanese delegation going home in frustration. It was pretty much closed off around the hotel, but I managed to just talk in a friendly way to some of the non-Seattle police forces that were dispatched, like the county sheriffs, and I'd ask them about their guns, and they'd ask me about my camera, and I managed to get in anyway. You just talk your way in. You see the woman sheriff is wearing her lipstick. A lot of the police had colds. They were pretty stressed out. So did a lot of protesters, but I wouldn't say stress was the main condition. It was more kind of exuberance and enthusiasm. This woman was an artist who decided that the police should be treated as if they were Medusa and confronted with a mirror. And this guy decided to do a little de Kooning
oil painting on site. I thought that was pretty impressive. You can see there's one woman there who doesn't think I should be making that picture. These are the kids, some of these younger people in the front are the kids from the high school you saw in devil suits. Steel workers. A spiral jetty made out of leaves. This was a confrontation on Capitol Hill that lasted till about 3 in the morning. And it's where I saw how the police, even in a situation where they didn't have the situation well in hand, they tried to use provocateurs just to end the thing. You know, like, we've spent enough money on overtime now. People want to go home. Let's start something so we can attack and get it over with. So they had a guy throw an egg, and immediately this person in plain clothes was sort of rushed through the line of charging police by two other plainclothes people and taken away. And so it was obvious that it was a setup. You know, it happened too quickly. And then, you know, we all were running with these wooden batons being fired and so on. So the even in you know, this is an old trick in the police bag that goes back to Vidocq and, you know, the early history of policing. You know, once you hire criminals as police, or you construct the police in such a way that they, as a formal institution, that they make use of what are essentially illegal tactics. You know, these things are never far away. I can talk about this a bit more. One of the things that happens, or at least happened to me, was I found a sort of affinity group of was two other people, and I spent a couple of evenings with them. And so they were both from Seattle, so where I went had a lot to do with what they knew about the city. And this woman who was a legal secretary was one of the two. This is visiting a squat. Visiting the studio of an artist who wasn't interested in going to the protest but had already been visited by the DEA because he worked with a lot of chemicals. And he happened to have a whoops, I think I skipped something here. No, I didn't. But okay, I'll finish that thought. A couple of strippers in one of the downtown sex clubs doing a little performance for me as I go by, commenting on the general masochism of the affair. Or contrasting their version of pain with the one that was being dealt out on the streets. I'm outside on the sidewalk. I didn't become a paying customer in that context. I don't think anybody was going in. So they were sort of hanging out, looking out through the door. This is back at the studio. He had a hazmat suit that had been left behind by the DEA people. And so we thought about wearing it to go up the hill, but we figured someone would get shot. Because the fear that was manufactured was that some protester was going to use sarin gas, you know. That's the end. Yeah, well, I'll have to go back, though. Let me see how to do that. Just one sec. Okay. There we are.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about this text and the way that it positions you in relation to what you are photographing. Because the whole issue of distance, of critical distance, is such a central part of Alan's earlier work, and it is, in a sense, relinquished here. And that seems to me a very important part of this. Even the tear gas. First of all, it connects up with the ocean, which is your big topic, its liquidity, et cetera. But also, although these tears are being artificially extracted, it is a very emotionally driven event. Mm. And you are abandoning the kinds of protective gear that would have allowed you to stand outside the event. Do you want to just talk about that?
Well, I did, you know, I mean, early on, I would go to protests. I remember during the Vietnam War and go up, find out who the plainclothes cops were from, you know, people who knew, and go up and try to photograph them. I did an early little series of six pictures of something like that. So I did, there was a side to what I did, which was about just being very confrontational with these authorities, you know, and seeing what would happen. And but it's true that once I was dealing in the more substantial early works I did, for example, about my parents and my father's long stint of unemployment, I did adopt this kind of severe distance.
Well, before we go there, let's just think about the nature of this protest, that it takes the form of waiting in effect for violence to be enacted, or occupying as a similar kind of, it's not an action strongly speaking, it occupies some kind of indeterminate middle ground between an action and a non-action, and it marks out a kind of fascinating political space. And by not wearing protective gear so that you were exposed to the tear gas as well and moving with the flow of the crowd, you participated in that politics.
And for example, there was a guy with the Longshore Union. You see him in the photo where the woman is holding the rubber bullets in her hand, and he goes, "Don't worry, we got your back," you know. So it was, there were a lot of gestures of support. And once you did get tear gas, people would come up, as I'm sure some of you might have experienced here. You know, people will pour water into your eyes or offer you lemons, as the barmaid is. And there are a lot of these very simple acts of generosity.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right that it's a combination of waiting and action. I mean, part of the idea is to just take over the street, make the city impossible to... make the functioning of the city impossible, you know. And I think in Seattle, the planners made three mistakes. One, they didn't think about the actual geography of the city. It's a small downtown. I mean, blockading a city like Philadelphia would be very similar, you know.
Yeah.
It's much harder in
LA,
in Los Angeles, yeah, as we found out at the time of the 2000 Democratic Convention, where there were a few street protests. And they were quite effectively blocked by the police. And that was the next chance, almost the next chance, I think, after 99, for a big trial, you know,
right,
of repressive tactics. But in Seattle, they didn't think about the geography or topography of the city's downtown. They didn't think about the labor history of Seattle, which, you know, involves the general strike in 1919. It's the most left-wing city on the left coast, barring perhaps Vancouver, except I'm not sure about Vancouver. I mean, it's a little hard to say. I think it's a hard comparison to make because it's a different country. And then the youth culture, you know, the sort of young people working for Amazon, working in tech companies and internet companies, and often marginally. I mean, and that, the intersection of that then with a kind of street culture,
yeah,
of young people and the music of that culture, these were all predisposed to be anti-authoritarian and not charmed by the sort of Bill Gates, you know, Seattle is an international city offensive, you know. Those three things, I think.
Yeah. And something else that I think warrants mention, although you don't have to comment on it if you don't want, is the coalitional nature, the way people are being brought together in ways that have nothing to do with traditional political groupings. That was such a feature of the anti-war demonstrations in the Bay Area, too, and is such an important part of Occupy. as we were going along, you were often marking the appearance of figures who would have been out of place in a traditional left-wing union, work-related demonstration or political action, and who might not even quite be there for the same reason, but some way of coming together, new ways of coming together, which I think is also a central feature of your work, of your aesthetic in many other ways. But let's go back in time to Aerospace Folktales.
Let me
say something about it ahead of time.
Yeah, this was a work I did in 1973. I started working on it in 71, so I was actually 20 when I started working on this project and was still an undergraduate student at the University of California at San Diego. I had only started photographing in about 71. I'd been making sculpture. I'd been painting for a while and making sculpture, and then I started doing kind of performance-like things, and I became interested in documenting performances. I mean, I would, and then I, with that in mind, I was approaching the idea of documentary with the notion that everyday life is performative. I mean, in part, this wasn't, you know, I was drawing on this from. Well, an interest in theater, I mean, which I think was very strong in the late 60s and 70s, you know, the people, Brechtian theater, but I was also interested in people like Grotowski and Poor Theater and the like. And in certain aspects of performance-related art, Vito Acconci's work, for example. The other kind of autobiographical aspect, which is very hidden in the work because the work takes this sociological distance, and it's only at a certain point in the work that you understand that this is a work about my parents, my family. But the sort of backstory, in a way, is that I had a kind of falling out with my parents when I was about 19 and spent a couple years, not really in, or a year and a little over, year and a half maybe, and not in communication with them. And then once I reestablished communication with them, I started photographing. So there had been some rough water under the bridge, you might say. But I was also in a way independent. You know, I mean, my dad was unemployed, so he was in no position to help me with the cost of school. I was also the beneficiary of the largesse that used to be visited upon California students if they did well. You know, I had scholarships. All of this a product of the very industries, you know, the kind of military-industrial hyper-development of California, you know, the sort of multi-university idea of Clark Kerr, where the university is kind of an engine of empire, if you want. And I was very much wanting to reflect on this because I thought I was making a work for people that might go into engineering or technical fields, you know, that, the very thing that I decided not to do in order to hope to become an artist. So my dad worked for Lockheed, and I often begin works with something from the orthodox, you know, sayings of whatever it is I'm looking at, you know. So there's a quote here from about Lockheed's position in the economy. And of course, this is roughly the time when both the diminishing of spending on the Vietnam War is leading to cutbacks in the aerospace industry, but Lockheed is also in trouble because they've been busy bribing, you know, everyone from Prince Bernhard in the Netherlands and various other officials in Europe so that they would buy fighter jets and, you know, the typical bribery that occurs with aerospace contracts. So the other thing was this is well before Metro Pictures and the idea of appropriation and the, you know, what Douglas Grimm calls the pictures generation, but I felt one needed to quote found images and reproduce them. So I begin with these details from... And then the structure of the work is pretty much this... I was thinking about silent film, you know, the intertitles in silent film. So right away, there's kind of what's... I'm introduced as a character, the... I never describe my father as my father, but rather as the engineer. My mother's the engineer's wife. So it's only in the later text of the work and in some of the recorded conversations that you understand that I'm not some free-floating agent of documentation.